So it's a genus of lizards belonging to the family, a family called Agamidae. And so these lizards are unique in their ability to be able to glide. There is one species in peninsular India, which is called Draco dusumieri. And there are about 39 species in Southeast Asia. So most of the Draco diversity is in Southeast Asia. So I wanted to work on the Indian Draco and possibly see how many species there might be within Draco dusumieri. So that's how it started. And then I got interested in an old hypothesis that was proposed like maybe 40, 50 years ago. It says that gliding invertebrates might have evolved because of the presence of tall trees in the region. So to give you some context, Southeast Asia has the most number of gliding vertebrates in the world.
Welcome back to Politics, Ecology, and Everything Else in Between. This is episode 5, and I'm your host, Rajiv. It's been a while since we did an episode on this podcast, but hey, here we are. Today, I have a very good friend of mine, Chaitanya, who has had an incredible journey so far, right from working at IBM to diving deep into the world of herpetology and evolutionary biology. We'll be exploring his fascinating research on gliding vertebrates, the impact of tall trees on their evolution, and how his passion for large data sets has driven his scientific exploration. This is a conversation you don't want to miss. Stay tuned as we unravel the connections between technology, nature, and the intricate web of life right in front of you. So let's dive right into the conversation. Welcome to the show, Chaitanya. Good to see you after so many years.
Good to see you too, Rajiv.
All right. So it's been what, more than a few decades, right?
A couple of decades, I think. And it's terrible to think of it that way. So let's not go down that path.
Really interesting to see your evolution in your career. You got into IBM. You spent 14 years in IBM.
Yeah.
And then what prompted you to shift into this field?
I joined IBM, I think, in 2001, and I was there until 2015 or so, or 14. I really had a good job in IBM, and a job that I liked. I was doing a lot of research, I was publishing a lot of patents and like writing research papers and so on. So it was fun. But somewhere down the line, I got interested in herpetology, and which is basically it's a science that deals with the study of amphibians and reptiles.
Right.
I got really smitten by the herpetology bug, if you will. And it was like a disease that just wouldn't go away. I thought it's like a fad and it's going to stick around for a while and then I'll lose interest, but it just never went away. Right. So around 2008, 2009, I started maybe meeting some herpetologists in India, going to the forests with them, trying to understand reptiles and amphibians in their natural habitat, how they behave, all that kind of stuff. And I also got interested in evolutionary biology a lot. So as a part of my job in IBM, I was one of those guys who built database softwares, right? And IBM had this marquee product called DB2, which was back then a very key database. This was before Oracle and stuff, right? And I used to work on graphs a lot, like graph theory. And so because indexes in databases usually are graphs. And so we needed to understand the mathematical basis of graph theory and so on. So, and then I started looking at evolutionary trees, which are also graphs, which are also basically directed acyclic graphs, as they call them. They're called trees. They're evolutionary trees that show relationships between organisms. So it was a natural fit there for me, right? I thought I could understand this stuff because of my background in graph theory and programming and so on. So all of that happened. And at one point, I realized that if I want to pursue these interests that I have in evolutionary biology and herpetology and so on, I would have to quit my job, and it's now or never. So in 2014, I think I took the decision to leave IBM and try and see where I can go with evolutionary biology and herpetology. So that's how it all started. And by this time, I'd already built a kind of a network in India of people who were evolutionary biologists, who were herpetologists. So I started working with all these guys, learning the ropes of the trade, if you will. And yeah, for about 6-7 years, I was basically wandering all over India in the forests and trying to see and document as many reptiles and amphibians as I could. Some of these surveys were formal because they were like, I was helping the forest department to document herpetofauna in certain forests in Tamil Nadu and the Northeast and so on. But most of it was just like random fun stuff where we just go to a forest, try and find some cool reptiles and amphibians and so on. And then COVID hit and I couldn't go to the forest anymore. And I was getting really buggered at home. So I decided I'll apply for PhD positions everywhere. So I wrote to a lot of people and Tel Aviv University worked out the best because they allowed me to work from India. All the American universities insisted that I be in the States for at least 2.5 to 3 years. So then I joined Tel Aviv University, which is this really fun lab that works on this field of biology called macroecology, though not directly related to the kind of stuff I would like to do or I wanted to do for my PhD. But my PhD guide was kind enough to allow me to do whatever I want. And we've been collaborating since then and we've come out with some cool stuff, I think. So it's been good since then. And I still am doing my PhD. It's probably hopefully my final year this year. So yeah, so that's the long and short of it.
So why gliding vertebrates?
So I started off my PhD off thinking I'll work on these really cool lizards from the Western Ghats in India called Draco. It's a genus of...
The Draco lizards. Yeah, yes. I was looking at them.
Yes. So it's a genus of lizards belonging to a family called Agamidae. And so these lizards are unique in their ability to be able to glide. There is one species in peninsular India, which is called Draco dusumieri. And there are about 39 species in Southeast Asia. So most of the Draco diversity is in Southeast Asia. So I wanted to work on the Indian Draco and possibly see how many species there might be within Draco dusumieri. So that's how it started. And then I got interested in an old hypothesis that was proposed like maybe 40, 50 years ago. It says that gliding in vertebrates might have evolved because of the presence of tall trees in the region. So to give you some context, Southeast Asia has the most number of gliding vertebrates in the world. And when I say gliding vertebrates, geckos, Draco lizards, squirrels, frogs, and this insanely cool animal called colugo, which is a mammal, and it is evolutionarily related to all the primates. And colugo there are just two species of colugo in Southeast Asia, and both of them glide. So I started trying to look at why are there so many species of gliders in Southeast Asia, right? Why that particular region? Then a cool story started emerging, which basically took my PhD in a completely different trajectory. So I realized that Southeast Asia also has the most number of tall trees in the world. The tropical forests of Southeast Asia are the tallest in the world. And they're chiefly composed of this family of trees called dipterocarps, right? You might have seen dipterocarps if you've been to forested regions in India and Papua New Guinea and so on and so forth, or Southeast Asia for that matter. So their seeds have two wings, right? So that's why they're called dipterocarps. And the seeds disperse and fall in a very peculiar manner. They spin in the air and basically the wings on the seeds help them disperse. They're very common trees in the Western Ghats too. So I wanted to make this correlation that it's because of the tall dipterocarp trees that there are so many gliding animals in Southeast Asia. So the story goes like this. So this is the context, but the story itself goes like this. So many million years ago, Southeast Asia did not have too many tall trees. It had short-treed evergreen forests, right? It had evergreen forests nevertheless, but the trees were not too tall, let's say 40 meters and that's that. And there were a lot of these organisms that were already occupying canopies of these short trees in Southeast Asia. So there were snakes, there were lizards, there were frogs, and all these animals that would use the canopy as a unique niche and would just persist and live there. And then around 50 million years ago, this is 50 million years ago, India basically, which was an island at that point of time, started coming closer and closer to Asia until it started docking with mainland Asia, where it is where we are presently right now in India, right? So that event was around 50 million years ago. And India brought with it some really tall trees, right? So India had separated from Africa around 100 odd million years ago, and it had started rapidly ascending the latitudes. And it crossed the equator, and around 50 million years, it came and docked with Asia, right? And India brought with it these tall trees called dipterocarps. And what happened when India docked was these dipterocarps, they just dispersed or migrated into Southeast Asia. And they started colonizing Southeast Asia. And by about 30 or 20 million years ago, the dipterocarp trees were the most dominant trees in the evergreen tropical forests of Southeast Asia, right? So now what happens to all these organisms that were occupying short tree canopies, right? Like your lizards and frogs and so on, snakes and all that. Now they suddenly had to deal with trees that are 80 meters tall or maybe even 100 meters tall. The tallest tropical tree has been reported from Sabah and Borneo, which is about It's a 100-meter tall shoria. So these organisms suddenly had to deal with these monuments of nature, if you will, right? Because they were not used to these tall trees. So over the course of a few million years, evolution took its toll on these animals. And these animals basically evolved the ability to glide. Because locomoting between tall trees, if you have to climb down a 100-meter tree and then walk the ground for a certain distance and then climb up another 100-meter tree to get to the next canopy, it just makes no sense in terms of energy expenditure and so on. So all these organisms, they started evolving the ability to glide. So let's say I'm a tiny lizard sitting at 80 meters on a tree, and right next to me is another tree on which there are ants, which is my favorite food. And to get to that food, I have to climb down 80 meters and climb up 80 meters again. It just makes no sense. So what did I do? I just evolved the ability to glide from one tree to the other, so I can completely bypass this whole climbing down and climbing up business.
Right.
So this is how gliding is hypothesized to have evolved in all these vertebrate animals. So I thought that was a really cool scenario to test many questions that I had about gliding and their association with tall canopy trees, right? So basically, this has made up two chapters at least of my PhD work. So for my first chapter, I show that basically gliding lizards like Draco, they are not able to disperse into regions in India where there are no tall trees. I built statistical models to show that the distribution of an organism like Draco, which is a glider, is constrained by canopy physiognomy. So they need a lot of canopy cover and really tall trees. So regions that are bereft of tall canopies, these animals just cannot disperse into. And then I also showed that during the course of my PhD that whenever there have been crises in the history of tall trees, like the evolutionary history of tall trees, like, for example, a mass extinction event, right, which essentially says that a lot of the tree diversity went kaput in a very short period of time, right? So that's the essential definition of a mass extinction event. So when such crises happened in tall trees, a similar crisis happened in the gliding vertebrates at the same time, because the gliding vertebrates were ecologically so closely associated with tall trees. So it's basically how a crisis in an organism cascades into a crisis on another organism that's entirely dependent on the former, right? So this is the kind of work I've been doing so far for my PhD. So this is specifically a case with the Southeast Asian gliders and the Southeast Asian dipterocarp trees. But this story can be extrapolated over space and time. I've further realized now that this is work that I've not done. Maybe I should do it at some point, but I further realized that wherever there are gliding vertebrates across the world, like for example, in Australia, you have the gliding marsupials, right? You have the sugar gliders, you have the greater glider, and all those. There's a good diversity of gliders in Australia. Similarly, you have, well, the flying squirrels are predominantly in Southeast Asia, which has about 52 odd species of them. And there are just a couple of species in North America and so on. Then there are an interesting group of rodents called the anomalures in Africa that also glide. And then there are a couple of frogs in South America that glide. And there is also this lacerated lizard in Africa that glides called the holaspis. And it does look like across space, globally, wherever there are gliding vertebrates, there are tall trees in those regions. For example, in Australia, the gliding marsupials seem to have evolved because of the presence of eucalyptus trees, which are phenomenally tall. Similarly, in Africa and South America, there are equally tall trees that have probably triggered the evolution of gliding in these groups. So basically, this association between gliding vertebrates and tall trees can be extrapolated over space. And I believe it can be extrapolated over time as well, over deep time. Primarily because there have been a lot of extinct gliding vertebrates. There have been a lot of reptiles that have gone, gliding reptiles that have gone extinct. A lot of gliding mammals that have gone extinct, and frogs too. And I believe that every instance of the evolution of gliding in the vertebrate tree of life has been triggered by the presence of tall trees in the region. One day probably I will try and test all of this, maybe for a postdoctoral position or something like that. But yeah, so that's something that I have in my head.
When DJ and I were going to the forest during our college time, we were very interested in the great pied hornbill.
Yeah.
That, interestingly, nests in tall trees.
Correct.
And many of these areas which were losing these trees were consequently, it affected the population of the hornbills.
Absolutely, yeah.
As well. that happening for these vertebrates as well?
I'm sure it is happening. I'm sure it's going on, just that no one has quantified it. Usually, it's common sense that when the habitat goes for a toss, then animals that are dependent on that habitat show rapid declines and so on. So I'm sure that's true for all the gliding vertebrates. So if you start chopping off tall trees or primary forests in the Western Ghats in Southeast Asia, where all this deforestation is quite prevalent, all these animals are going to go, they're going to start facing massive crises and with the likely risk of going extinct. So it's a true and present danger.
From IVM to gliding vertebrates, one thing I think which is common is your skill with a database and data sets and all the large data sets.
I love large data sets, yes. I love large data sets. And I think it, to a large extent, it helps being an engineer because it's helped me in a lot of ways in terms of thinking analytically and writing code especially. I never thought I'd write code being a biologist. But the amount of code I've written in the last few years just for my research is quite appalling, to say the least. Yeah, so all that really helps. And also, it's a paradigm shift from a kind of a mathematical background, if you will, because engineering is a lot of maths, to a biological framework where you want to do research. So in computer science, it's largely zero and one, right? So it's all binary. It's quite easy. So you either have a right answer or you have the wrong answer, right? But in biology, one of the things I had to adjust to, and I think I'm still adjusting to it, is the fact that there is no real right or wrong answers. It's all like a gradient of gray in between. And so it takes a little getting used to that fact, coming from a strictly binary background.
You did your MCA, am I right, in MKU?
Yeah, I did a master's in science and computer science, not technically MCA.
Right. Shifting from that to a science background, did you have any challenges? It's like black and white, right? It's like studying biology and zoology is so much different from studying C++ and Pascal and whatever.
Yeah, thankfully my course was not not too applications oriented, like an MCA course or a BE course would be. It was a little more theory oriented, in fact. We got a good understanding of the theoretical basis of computer science. So that way it was helpful in a sense. Biology, in terms of being another science, it is quite similar, right? The way you approach addressing a scientific problem is very similar, whether it's computer science or biology. However, like I said, biology involves, very rarely are there right and wrong answers in biology. It's always like a gradient, and biggest challenge was getting used to that gradient, in fact, and not a lot else. Everything else comes because you're just deeply interested in all this stuff. So you just learn as you go. You don't find it that hard.
Which are the forests that you study? Is it restricted to India or is it across Southeast Asia?
For my PhD, it's been across Southeast Asia, but I didn't really have to visit those forests because a lot of this data was already there in the internet, right? There's a big push and increase in the amount of citizen science data that's being published on the internet over the last decade or so. And that's being really helpful for researchers like me, where we actually don't have to go and collect all this primary data, which will probably take us decades to do. So essentially use all the citizen science data that is flagged off as research grade, and come up with interesting questions, repurpose this data and just use it. So that's the way I've been going about it so far. But in India, I've done a lot of field work with the gliding lizard in India, the Draco dosumieri. That involved traveling from Kanyakumari up to, say, Maharashtra, where these Dracos are found. Yeah, so in terms of field work, I've been all over the Western Ghats, you know, multiple times, many times over. I've also been to the Eastern Ghats and the northeast of India and the Andamans and so on and so forth. So wherever there are wet forests, I just generally like to go there because it just makes me happier.
Tell me something, is it this Draco lizard, is it found only in forests or because increasingly cities are encroaching, people are encroaching into forests and development is happening.
Yeah.
How does that work? How does it affect these lizards? Or are they adapting to these changing dynamics?
No. So like I said, they need tall trees to persist, right? So in regions without tall trees, they just cannot survive. So in urban, semi-urban areas, you won't see them at all. Even if these places are nestled within proper evergreen forests, you will see them in plantations that are surrounded by primary evergreen forests. Like you will see them in areca plantations, sometimes tea plantations and so on, coffee plantations and so on and so forth. But that is not their primary habitat. They just opportunistically use these plantations for whatever they need and so on. But they primarily live in the forests.
And do they live in the canopies or do they come down at all? They don't come down.
That's an interesting question. So they live in the canopy. They are in the canopies, but they do have to come down for various reasons. Because when you're in the canopy, your visibility is not great, right? So for things like courtship, when a male wants to court a female, the male has to come down and start flashing his dewlap. So a dewlap is basically this appendage on the neck of the animal. And these lizards like Draco, they flash the dewlaps to attract females. And to be able to do that, so that's a visual cue, which means that a female has to be able to see this male flashing his dewlap, right? And because it's a visual cue, the organism has to come down from the canopy where it gets exposed. So they do come down, but they never come to the ground. They never, ever in their lives have to come to the ground, except for a gravid female who wants to lay her eggs, right? A female Draco would come down maybe once in her life, dig a little hole in the ground at the bottom of the tree, lay her eggs, close that hole, like basically close her pseudo nest and climb the tree back up. And that is just exactly once in the life of a female Draco. A male Draco never ever has to come down on the ground.
And talking about evolution, how did it actually evolve? Of course, you talk about natural selection, but how did it actually develop that wing?
That's an interesting question. I presume, I'm just speculating here, but I presume that it is mostly the canopy-dwelling vertebrates that evolved the ability to glide. I don't think it was other arboreal vertebrates that were in the lower canopy or somewhere mid-trunk on the tree or that were occupying smaller trees or shrubs and things like that. It's always the upper canopy animals that have evolved to glide across time and space. That said, there has to be an underlying genetic mechanism to why these vertebrates, amongst so many other vertebrates, evolved the ability to glide, right? So that is something no one has studied before, and there's probably something I'd like to do in the future. I don't know how feasible it will be. That would involve comparing the genotypes of all these gliders across the world. Because if you get the drift of what I'm saying, gliding is something that is not evolved because of ancestry and descent across the vertebrate tree, right? What I mean by that is lizards like Draco are completely unrelated to squirrels, the gliding squirrels. The gliding squirrels are completely unrelated to gliding frogs, which are completely unrelated to the rodents in Africa that glide. So gliding, as you would say, is a convergently evolved trait, which means it's not come down because of ancestry and descent, but it's happened because all these organisms at different parts of the world were reacting to very similar ecological pressures in the areas that they live in. And this ecological pressure, as we know today, is the presence of tall trees. So the presence of tall trees has essentially triggered the evolution of gliding convergently across the vertebrate tree of life over 30 times. To give you another example of convergence, it's a classical example is the ability of powered flight between birds and bats and insects too, a lot of insects. So these are completely unrelated groups. Birds are not related to bats immediately, or you know, these groups are not related to insects. But why did they evolve the ability to fly? Because they were reacting to certain common ecological pressures that they all had. So these organisms evolved convergently across time and space, but what is the underlying genetic mechanism that allows them to do? So that's a very interesting question that I would like to answer at some point in my life, but we'll see how that goes. So what I suspect is that there must be some genotypic character in their genome, which allows them to naturally select the trait of gliding, whereas other vertebrate organisms don't have that. So that's what I suspect. And if and when I do the study, that's what I would hypothesize and expect to find.
Are these endangered by any chance? I mean, what's the situation?
A lot of the animals in Southeast Asia are endangered, and most of the gliders live in Southeast Asia. So I presume a majority of them are endangered, especially because Southeast Asia, the various countries in Southeast Asia, especially Indonesia, they've been going at it when it comes to logging and palm oil cultivation, which is like threatening orangutans, as we know. But people usually talk about great apes and the tigers because, I mean, great apes are more closely related to humans. So we somehow have this visual connection with apes and monkeys, but not as much with, let's say, squirrels or lizards or frogs, because they don't look anything like us. But with all the deforestation that's going on in Borneo and other parts of Java, Sumatra, and all these places, a lot of these gliders are likely to quickly go extinct.
This is not in the mainstream media or information, right?
Yes.
Gliding vertebrates. You have the orangutans and, like you said, But is there anything being done to bring it to top of mind? Other species which are being similarly threatened?
So unfortunately, what happens is the money is where the fur is, as I say very often, right? When you talk about tiger conservation, there's a lot of money pumped in. If you know the scene in India, there's so much of money with tiger conservation, elephant conservation. Similarly with giant pandas in China and orangutans and the great apes. Because wherever there's fur, there's a lot of money. But with reptiles and amphibians, smaller mammals, no one actually cares. And because there's no money, there's not a lot of research that happens. And because of that, we don't know as much as we know about the large, charismatic, iconic animals or mammals like tigers and elephants and so on. That's how it is. That's the state of affairs. But so we have to live with it. You can't do much about it.
Okay. If you look at that big tree hypothesis that you have, what's happening on that side of it? Because the presence of those big trees are getting reduced day by day, right?
That's true, yeah. So I can talk about India because I'm not really aware of what's happening in Southeast Asia, what their conservation policies are. In India, I'm quite certain there are none because recently there was an amendment to the Forest Act, a very recent amendment that was passed in the parliament, which basically says that the government can deallocate any amount of land, any amount of forest land for things like mining and industrialization, urbanization and whatnot. So that's going to spell doom.
That's disaster, man.
Yes, it's complete disaster. And I would recommend anybody who loves the forest to spend as much time in the forest right now because we're not going to have them maybe in a decade or decade and a half. So it's quite a bad situation in India. And it's exacerbated by population growth and the demand for all these highly depletable resources. It's a combination of all these things that's leading to all this deforestation. So I'm not an expert to talk about all these things, but I know that this is the surface of the problem. Someone who's an active conservationist will be able to tell you in greater details the horror show that's going on in India right now.
These are like interesting stuff that you're doing in terms of gliding vertebrates and stuff, which normally is not in the mainstream media. It's right. Not a common story, right? Yeah. But it's an interesting story nevertheless, because just the thought that gliding has originated in different species, unrelated species, because of an ecological response to a phenomenon which they're interacting with,
correct,
is fascinating to me, right?
Correct. And it ties into your podcast, like it says everything is connected, right? So
exactly. You have gliding lizards and you have gliding squirrels and you have gliding frogs even. Come on.
Yes. So they're all so completely unrelated, but yet they're connected in the way they respond to the same ecological pressure the same way.
One of the objectives of this podcast is talk to scientists like you and demystify these, because I'm asking stupid questions, which I really don't know. I'm probably the typical layman.
There's no such thing as a stupid question, right? It just doesn't exist. If I'm not able to answer that question, then it's really my shortcoming and not yours. That's the way I see it.
And that's the objective of this podcast as well, right? Mm-hmm. It's purely trying to deconstruct the science so that people can understand it. So what is the next step for you in terms of the research going? So once you complete it, will there be follow-up studies that you'll be doing?
I'm not sure yet, because I've been talking about or thinking about gliding and tall trees for the last 4 years. So that's taken a toll. I'm a little bored of that right now. So I probably want to move on to answering other questions that I find interesting. But if the right opportunity comes by, I think I will try and answer some of these other questions related to gliding in tall trees that I have in my head. But ideally, I'd like to move on to other things. I'm very interested in macroevolution, which essentially looks at evolution from a larger scale, as the name implicitly suggests, and trying to find out how different organisms may have evolved different traits or similar traits, though they're completely unrelated, across the tree of life. I like to unearth patterns in evolution, the evolutions of unrelated organisms, where they have similar patterns and so on, which is quite fascinating. I'm quite interested in biogeography, which is the study of the distributions of extinct and modern species across the world and what governs their distributions, right? Because there has to be a reason why an animal just stops at a certain place. Its range just ceases to exist. So why does that happen? What prevents an animal from moving from place A to place B, things like that. So hopefully in the future, where I get to do a lot of significant work on macroevolution and biogeography specifically. That's where I want to go.
And will you be a researcher through and through, or will you be going to teaching as well?
I want to be a researcher through and through. I don't think I have enough patience to be able to teach. I mean, I do teach, but it's once a month or something, which is fine, but it can't be my daily job. Not the way I see it. So I just want to continue doing research till people kick me out and tell me I'm too old.
Cool, man. Nice. Good stuff. A lot of interesting stuff. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Rajiv. Thank you. It was very nice to connect with you after so long.
Well, that was a wrap for episode 5. Thanks, Chaitanya, for coming on this podcast. It was great chatting with you. So listeners, would love to know what you think of this episode. Subscribe to this podcast and listen in on some interesting discussions. Till the next one, take care.